Hello and welcome to the Business Podcast. I am your host, Amin Siala, and today I'm with Chris Corbishley, who is an investor at Forward Partners, who's been kind enough to invite us to do this episode right here at Forward Partners. Chris, thanks a lot for inviting us.
Yeah, thanks for, I'm very flattered to be asked to appear on the show.
So,
yeah.
Awesome. So Chris has got a PhD from Imperial College Business School, focus was in organisational economics, and you've done a raft of different exciting projects, amongst which you work part-time with the London Stock Exchange on the Elite Programme, helping scale-ups. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So I'll actually take you back to my initial sort of getting into the PhD at Imperial very quickly. So did a master's before that, got super excited about some of the research that was happening, really excited about space-specific research done by my supervisor at the time, who was working across innovation, entrepreneurship, really kind of from big companies or large organizations deploying really interesting infrastructure rollouts in India and East Africa, but then at the same time had this incredible ability to be working in other domains. So it just so happened I joined right at the point where there's a lot of interest in this research we're doing around energy sort of deployment in very kind of high risk areas, so geographically risky areas, in terms of like economic and market risk. But at the same time, getting super interested in this program through the business school, which is called Elite. And the whole focus of that in 2014, there's a big interest in scale ups. So there's a generous belief across the government that scale ups is where economic growth really the power.
Can you tell us the difference? So what's the difference between a startup and a scale up?
So yeah, a scale-up has a very strict definition. There's a whole scale-up institute that defines it as minimum EBITDA, minimum revenues of 5 million and compound annual growth of sort of 10 to 20%. So we've got clear ambitions to grow. So it's not just a company that's been sitting on 5 million year on year, it's actually growing super fast. And the cohort in the first instance were companies like Graze.com, BrewDog, or some sort of like crowdfunding, like entirely new business models that come out of nowhere. An online furniture business that I ended up going to work for after my PhD. So
furniture.
It's an online furniture business. Yeah, it's
exciting industry.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Yeah. So it was at a time when I think online penetration for furniture e-commerce was about 3%. It was at about 8% by the time I left.
So which year was this that it was only 3%?
So that was in 2010, 2011.
2010 and 3%, and then when you left, which year was that? It went to 8%.
So I left Swoon in 2015, it was 8%.
Yeah. And I'm assuming it's continuing to grow.
So that was the market growth. Yeah. So yeah, you can just imagine what that was like for a business.
That's interesting. So you did your master's at Imperial, then did you plan beforehand to do a PhD?
Absolutely not. So I had been applying for sort of, I think IBM had an interesting consultancy position, applied for that, applied for a few others, also had a sort of like a startup idea in mind that we'd won some like about 10k of funding for. But we ended up not taking it because we did a bit of due diligence on the market and realized it was probably never going to take off.
That's a wise step, I guess. Not many would have the wisdom or maturity level to do that, but
it was a tough call, I have to admit. But I also at the same time received a scholarship to do the PhD from the Economic and Social Research Council, and that sort of gold dust is super hard to get to get these opportunities, and it gave me an opportunity to really focus on something I really loved for three and a half years, and just so hard to turn that down.
Before we get into the world of VC, you've got a significant interest in renewables. Why does it excite you?
Yeah, so renewables, it's unfortunate, that's not necessarily such an interest anymore. Because we're a tech firm, so we invest in sort of online businesses, software, so less in renewables, but it was certainly a large focus of my my PhD. So I ended up working very closely. So my supervisor in the first instance, we're working on a grant-funded project in East Africa, in Kenya, in a tiny little village, with about 500 households deploying microgrids. So there's this kind of crazy paradox where the technology that was probably the most appropriate for the context was unfinanceable. So in the Sunbelt countries of Africa and parts of India, solar PV makes perfect sense. But because it was still quite risky at the time, and even though the costs had come down hugely, largely due to China's manufacturing at scale, it was still a risk if it was unfinanceable, just because the capital costs were so high. So the cost of capital to finance these projects was too high.
What are your thoughts on M-Pesa? How did they manage to infiltrate the market?
Yeah, so M-Pesa is awesome. I mean, that's a great story of leapfrogging Western economies, largely due to technology leapfrogging, but due to just the ubiquity of mobile phones. And obviously, this was definitely an end user play. It was highly subsidised, bear in mind, by you know,
Kenyan government.
Was
that critical? Was
very much so. So it was very much due to large operators kind of, you know, helping deploy the infrastructure, so actual mobile towers to make that work, and then low cost devices.
Right.
Because it was very much a consumer play and there was a sort of financing layer on top,
right.
It was an instantly monetizable business. Whereas electricity, you've got so many different dynamics in electricity markets. You've got grids that are kind of close by, but the technology is, well, the reach is just not big enough, and the density of population is just, it's not there. And you've got all sorts of other different competing stakeholders and forces which mobile networks just can completely avoid.
Interesting. So how did you end up in Forward Partners?
So it's quite an interesting story there. So I just kind of track back. So yeah, I did the PhD, had been working part-time with the London Stock Exchange, meeting really cool scale-ups, and just really fell in love with one. It had this really interesting vision around zero stock, zero lead time. So literally taking furniture directly from a supplier in Southeast Asia, or well, actually 20 suppliers in 15 different countries, directly to the consumer's door. And to do that, you had to get a lot of predictability on what you might sell in 3 months' time, for instance. So it requires like quite heavy modeling, like optimization, demand forecasting, building different features to make it better and better and better. So I'd been doing that at Swoon for about a year, and got really interested in this challenge that was fairly widespread across the e-commerce market marketplace.
Not just exclusively for furniture.
Yeah, so it could be anything. It could be shoes. It could be. It sort of works much more effectively for high value goods like furniture, just because it costs a lot to store, and you know, it's probably, you know, you've got a lot more in terms of inventory that you're thinking about.
Yeah.
But generally, it was something that affected a lot of e-commerce businesses, I started to get inbounds. So lots of people were asking me to kind of meet up with them for coffee, or you know, speak at a few events to talk about, you know, how you could start to deploy, you know, these kind of models.
What was it that you called it again?
Zero stock, zero lead time.
Okay, zero stock, zero lead time.
So that was very unique to the Swoon business model. There's not many furniture companies doing that.
Okay, how similar is this to the just in time?
So that's the business model, and then the execution is this kind of is honing in on this. So zero stock, so you don't hold anything in the warehouse.
Right.
Hence, just in your, just in time, direct to consumer, there's lots of different sort of buzzwords for it.
Yeah.
But the zero lead time, that was the hard one to beat, because you got, you know, it takes a month between putting the purchase order with suppliers and X factory, and you've got a month on the water, and then you've got, well, you know, maybe a few days to actually deliver it.
Yeah.
So that was where you really needed some statistical sort of firepower to get that right.
What kind of impact was it having on the companies, empirically speaking?
So it was certainly inherent in the business model right from the beginning, but it was hard to actually prove it out with such small data set. So when you're starting out, you've actually not got that much data. It's quite a common problem that we encounter now with across many different startups. It's this cold start problem.
Cold start.
So you've got no, you start with no data, right? But you're trying to use data to optimize your business model.
Right.
So
Catch 22.
Yeah, exactly. So we were just coming up with some really innovative ways of kind of doing that. Lots around kind of email campaigns, looking at product page views. It's quite sort of well-known things across the market now, but at the time it's quite cutting edge. And then once we got to kind of critical mass in terms of number of SKUs, number of orders, number of sales coming through, we could hit about 80-90% on our best sellers in terms of accuracy. And so you'd back test every 3 to 6 months, you'd back test, compare your forecast to actual sales, and it was very accurate.
Okay, so and then you
So got lots of interest in doing that elsewhere. Started to work with other sort of companies. It could be a marketplace business or a so e-commerce business that had exactly the same problem and just wanted to, there's two sort of two-step challenge there. So I kind of teamed up with a couple of other friends trying to do this, both colleagues at Imperial and kind of recently did their PhDs. And we were starting to look at sort of different challenges. It could be a marketplace with a disintermediation problem. So you've got two-side marketplace, but the, you know, the actual one side of the market is just disintermediating the platform. So they'll use it to build up their own customer base and then go straight to the end user. Or it's another e-commerce business with exact same demand forecasting problem.
Right.
And started to work with them on sort of tactical problems. Firstly, kind of getting all the data in one place. And then the second one, actually deploying models on top of that data in an automated way. So it's not just discrete analyses happening every few weeks.
Okay.
This is something that's actually inherent in the operating model of the company.
Right.
And it's funny, so I was also at the same time working with Imperial to help them build their enterprise lab. So I came back, I got a call from my sort of a professor I worked with very closely, and he said, you know, we've just got this like amazing funding to build this enterprise lab, and it's something that I was so passionate about when I was at Imperial and sort of was waiting for it to happen. It just so happened that they it all kicked off when I left, you know, a year after I left.
Well, you're always welcome to visit anytime.
Yeah, and actually, I got
you do come regularly, which is just great.
I do. I'm a big fan of the college, and you know, spent a good 4 or 5 years of my life there, and the students are just phenomenal. You know, they're all working on incredible stuff.
Yeah.
So I had a really, really incredible experience working with the students for the kids for 6 months.
Well,
after.
I mean, I'll give you a shout out. You came to us for a couple of hours actually, MSc Innovation Entrepreneurship Management.
Yes,
and that was useful. You know, like a lot of my peers really enjoyed it when you came. It's, you know, it's great to really give back, right, and share the knowledge. You've got direct first hand experience here at Forward.
That's it.
And to be able to come back and just relay some of that information is phenomenal.
Yeah, and actually, so just to finish the story, so I did end up pitching that business to actually in this room where you're sitting,
really?
To an investor here who, you know, I think found it very interesting, you know, interesting use case, and basically told me that there's 10 other companies doing the same thing.
Okay.
You
came here to pitch this idea in this very room?
At office hours. So I applied to office hours.
Okay, right, which we will get to in a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you were pitching it.
Pitch
and then
the
he
business.
Told you there's 10 other companies did exactly the same thing, Chris.
Well, he just gave me some like very candid advice and stuff that I was just blind to, because obviously VCs, you know, we have meetings every day, like 3 or 4 meetings, and you know, you really have a sense of the pulse on the startup land. You really have a really deep inherent knowledge of the market, which is why VCs are great.
You have to.
Yeah, exactly. You live and die off the back of that. So,
yeah.
So it's just, it was such an, I'd never actually sat in front of a VC before pitching a business. And
so it was the first time?
First time.
Wow.
And just gave me some really interesting insight. It really made me think very carefully about what next steps were.
Mm.
I was running a consultancy model effectively where I really hadn't had the time to productize what I was doing. I felt that it's inherently productizable, like I could build a white label solution to this and start to roll it out as a SaaS proposition, potentially, but I started to look at the market, and there were quite literally 10 other companies doing exactly the same thing. But what was unique is that at the exact same moment I pitched the business, Ford Partners had just closed their second fund.
Mm.
So
2017?
2017, around April time. And they just closed their second fund. They had a fund one was around 20 million.
Okay.
All e-commerce, marketplace, sort of SaaS type, you know, platforms, and they had made about 37 investments in that space. And the way fund cycles tend to work, once you close the first fund, you raise the second one.
Okay.
To kind of time just after the close of the first.
Sure.
And yeah, it's sort of perfect timing, and the focus for that fund was applied artificial intelligence.
Wow. The second or the first one?
Second fund.
The second one.
But it was still across all those original horizontals, so it could be e-commerce, marketplace, even SaaS businesses, but you're applying machine learning or some kind of optimization to do what other people are doing 5, 6, maybe 10 times better, or just addressing a problem that you previously couldn't address with some more generic digital solutions.
Okay.
So it's perfect timing. And it's funny, I don't know what happened in between this, the point when I pitched and when I got this call, but I got a call 2 weeks later from the head of talent. So there's a head of talent
here
at Forward, and they just said, listen, Chris, you know, the team were really impressed with your pitch, but you know, we don't think there's any legs there.
So, okay.
However, we've got an investment role opening up, and I had, you know, I said absolutely, I'd be very keen to come in and meet the team.
Right.
I went through 3 interviews.
Three.
Yeah. So you start off, you have pitch decks, all companies that they've either invested in or thought about investing in, and you have to say which ones you'd invest in and why. Fortunately, I picked the right one. Got through to the second one, which is a case study.
Sorry, I want to know more about that. So they give you 3 companies.
So you get a choice, so a pre-seed or a seed stage deck, and then you kind of pick one that you'd invest in and explain why.
And why is there a right and a wrong answer?
I think, provided you give your rationale as to why you would or wouldn't invest in one, you would still be, you know, still get through, right?
Okay.
As long as it's a really solid, but if you've kind of picked one which is clearly off strategy, or it's just the market's not venture scale, the product is totally undifferentiated, there may be so many different reasons why you'd turn it down. I was just very lucky that I chose the right one and actually ended up meeting the company that's in the room with us.
Oh, really? So they were real companies?
Real companies, yeah. So yeah, and then second was a case study, much more rigorous, bit of modeling. And then a final one, you meet all the partners. So there's 3 partners. You meet them all individually as well as as a team.
Yeah.
And it's all about fit, really. But in VC, you're working with these guys all every day, really testing each other's assumptions, working together as a team to kind of build the business.
On this point, how important are relationships in this industry?
They're fundamental. Yeah. I mean, I think I came in thinking I could have a sort of data-driven approach to a VC. I think it certainly helped us with things like lead gen, so casting the net a little bit wider, tracking the quality of deals by source and optimizing for those channels. So we started to realize which channels drive the best deals.
Right.
And, you know, coming up with a data-driven approach to the process. But in terms of the actual business and where the best deals come from, it's all about network. It's about the best deals always come through, you know, maybe the partner's inbox or another VC, actually.
Yeah.
It's a very tight-knit community. You have to be nice. You have to be very kind of switched on and interested in the tech itself.
Yeah.
And you just have to, you know, really kind of network, but in a very sort of light touch way. Like, it's just about getting to know people and and chatting through your assumptions, because ultimately every investment strategy is based on a lot of assumptions.
So you're claiming then that network trumps data?
That's a tough one to call. And, you know, you see other VCs who make it their USP, right? So if you look at companies like InReach Ventures.
I was just about to mention them. Yeah, they're using data and artificial intelligence to source deals.
And I'm always curious to know, exactly what's going on under the hood there. So I do know some friends there, but they never give it away. But I'm always curious about questioning exactly how that works.
Apparently they've been building it for years. So I was actually speaking to Roberto yesterday, but Bonanzinga from InReach. And, you know, they've been working on this for years, but they have managed to make a few successful investments from them, which I think is phenomenal, to be honest, because it's different, right?
And I totally agree. I think Series A onwards, it can work for sure.
Right.
Like, actually, I think in that instance, it does make sense.
Okay.
At our stage, it's all about serendipity, right?
So, your stage is?
So to clarify, we are the world's earliest stage VC investor. You will not find a VC firm, like a real actual VC firm with LPs and like the traditional structure that's investing as early as we are. You know, you've got the accelerators and the incubators at the very sort of bottom end of the funnel, if you think about sort of an entrepreneur's journey. And that's always a volume game. So they're placing 20, 50K checks on hundreds of businesses.
Right.
We don't
spray and pray.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it is a numbers game, statistics, really, at that level. And you certainly can de-risk your portfolio by doing that way, but that's not our approach. It's actually not traditional VC approach either.
It's not, okay.
So we what we do instead is, you know, we invest up to 300K at pre-seed.
Up to 300K?
Yeah.
Pre-seed?
So pre-seed, so that could quite literally be an idea, back of a napkin. You know, but they have to have enough credibility and hustle to pull it off.
Wow.
And they have to be going after a large market with a really great product vision.
Right.
At seed, we invest up to $1 million. And that's typically... Seed stage, it's quite normal for most other, compared to other seed investors, it's very similar. So the companies tend to have a bit more traction.
Right.
They have a fully fledged team, a product that's built.
Yep.
But pre-seed is starting from zero. And what's unique about our model is that we're real partners. We invest so much more than just capital.
Mm-hmm.
We have an operating team of around 15 people. So it's two full stack developers, UX designers, head of product, who's a partner in the fund. Head of growth, head of talent. It's effectively a scale-up team in miniature.
Right.
And that team work with the pre-seed companies who are based with us in the room. And it gives them a chance to de-risk their venture, because ultimately it's all about execution in terms of like speed as well as the effectiveness of the execution. And these guys, you know, we've invested in 20 pre-seed companies now, and these guys are sort of seasoned experts. They've all come from Facebook, Google, Mindcandy, like, you know, great businesses.
Right.
And they've got a lot of operational experience, and they're bringing that to the table from day one.
Do you think this is a new trend? Because, I mean, I'm aware that Sequoia has actually started to invest in seed. They didn't traditionally, right?
Mm.
Why is this happening? Why are we seeing a lot of VC firms go down the funnel?
So there's a couple of reasons. One is the sheer amount of capital. So due to sort of current financing conditions and how cheap money is and how low interest rates are.
People take advantage of that.
Yeah, so in more traditional asset classes, it's hard to make decent returns. Mm. So there's a big push towards riskier assets, of which VC is probably the riskiest, but it's definitely one of them. So you see the same in private equity, but VCs is happening as well.
Right.
And that's getting very concentrated around Series A and beyond. So I think there's a lot of more traditional funds that are moving earlier in the funnel in order to differentiate themselves a bit more.
Right, okay.
There's a second reason for doing that, and it's it comes partly due to, you know, you as a fund have to believe you can actually provide some value at that stage. So you have to believe that you can make some impact in terms of the execution of that business at such an early business. Because
right.
a Series A, it's actually fairly de-risked. It's just all around market assumptions.
Yeah.
And if the entrepreneur can really scale it. But it's just the amount of risk at this stage is phenomenal. And
particularly pre-seed.
Pre-seed, yeah.
So what is it that you look for then? I mean, pre-seed, arguably it's pre-seed. They barely have anything.
Yeah.
What do you go by? Is it team, the people, the product, the patents?
It's the usual three things. So it's the team, it's the founder. It's tend to be a solo founder or maybe a co-founder.
And what kind of traits are you looking for?
So we actually score each one on a sort of five-factor scale. Okay. It's nothing particularly special. It's just, but it's quite important for us to really... get a sense of, we actually use it for our own, we back test this as well.
So a scale you made in-house?
Yeah.
So it's a forward scale, isn't
it? Yeah, but it's fairly, I think most VCs will be doing something similar, but we score them out of five on six different attributes. We decide, you know, does this person, and often they score less on the product and the tech front because those are the things we bring in, we have in-house.
Right, okay.
And that's how the team around them can then be built from seed on.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Complementary skills.
Yeah.
You bring the tech, they bring the passion, the commitment.
Yeah. Ultimately, you know, I think there's the whole hustler, hacker, and the, what was the third one? I think it's like hipster. That's
okay.
It. So ultimately, we're looking for a hustler because we've got the hip, you know, we're in Old Street, we're in a cool studio, we've got the hipsters.
Yeah, the office is very hip actually.
Yeah, it's cool space. Yeah, we've got the hackers, we've got the tech guys, we've got the growth guys, and the product guys. But the founder needs to bring that kind of really hustling mentality. They have to have a deep domain expertise. If you look at the portfolio, you know, a lot of them are kind of ex McKinsey consultants, worked in healthcare for 6 years. Wow. Spot an opportunity in you know, a platform for helping cancer sufferers.
Right.
So that's Live Better With. We have Lexu, you know, previously a Magic Circle lawyer who didn't want to go down the partner track but saw an opportunity to build a legal marketplace for SMEs and lawyers.
You mentioned these are some portfolio companies.
Yeah, these are the portfolio companies that have gone through pre-seed.
Right, and so they've successfully managed to raise Series A?
Well beyond. So the first ever pre-seed investment was a peer here. So it's an Airbnb for commercial real estate.
Right.
So Ross was a little bit different. So he left school at 16, pitched his business at 19 to Ford Partners. And you know, they're now way beyond sort of Series B territory.
Tell me about that bit when you connect them from the seed onto Series A. Have you built these strategic partnerships with other?
So we're co-invested with every sort of major VC fund out there. So like Google Ventures, Index, Octopus, you know,
Balderton.
Yeah. So effectively, the way we see it, we're feeding the top of the funnel.
Right.
So these guys invest at Series A, and they're looking for great, high quality candidates. And because we're all sort of, most of the team from a VC background, they know what it takes to have good investments at Series A and seed.
Right.
So we know that, you know, they need to get a £1 million run rate, they need 20% month on, or 30, 40% month on month growth.
Yeah.
They need a full-time team, four or five people covering the main functional areas, and fully-fledged products, and they have to own the tech as well. So all those things are in place at seed.
Yeah.
We just did a five-year retro, looking back at the stats. We could prove the model works.
Really?
So okay. We get...
So the science behind this then?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Which it was amazing. So that's the first project I did when I came in. I started to look at the portfolio and say, right, is this model working?
Okay.
And, so
you've got a mug that says about data.
Yeah.
You're a data lover there, Chris.
That's it. You know, this
I'm a data beast.
it definitely, you know, it does help to have these, to bring these skills to a sort of, to maybe not so sleepy industry, because VC is, you know, it's cutting edge, but actually the species out there that just don't think this way.
I heard the word bleeding edge yesterday, cutting edge, bleeding edge. But what about office hours?
Okay.
Let's open office hours.
Hours. So we need to design in a lot of serendipity at pre-seed.
Okay.
It's a very different ball game. So to put into context, we see 3,000 leads a year.
3,000?
We meet 300, we invest in 10. So the fun, we as I said, we don't sort of, it's not spray and pray, we pick winners and we support them relentlessly.
Right, okay.
But first of all, we have to meet them. And it's really like diamonds in the rough stuff there, because there's a lot of ideas out there and you've got to pick the one that sort of is the winner. And as I mentioned, we've got those three things we look at, the founder, the product vision, and the market. So is this a venture scale market?
Okay.
And so office hours gives us an opportunity. We get about 150 applications a month. People come from all sorts of different sources. Could be Google search, an event, an accelerator.
And again, you've got the data for this.
We track all of those, and we optimize for those channels, and we track quality scores.
Right.
So if we know that, for instance, Google Campus sends us the best leads, we run an event series there.
Interesting.
So, you know,
and four out of your, I read on the website, 4 out of 40 companies you've invested in
from
the office apps.
Yeah, so as I said, so 150 apply, we take 20 through for 15-minute meetings back-to-back with three investors here.
Yeah.
It's not really a pitch session. We have an application. We ask some questions.
So you do review beforehand?
Of course, yeah. So we really look into detail.
Not everyone's coming through the door, essentially. There is some sort of filtering system.
Very much so.
How rigorous is that filtering system?
10% get through, as I mentioned, between 10 and 15%. And It's pretty rigorous. So you have to really tick those boxes, and there's a lot of guidelines on our website to help educate the founders to know what we're looking for. So they're fairly well prepared by the time they get here. And those 15 minutes is an amazing opportunity to meet unnetworked founders. So most founders at seed stage are very well networked. They know all the VCs, they're sending very polished pitch decks. But here we're trying to meet like technically brilliant people.
Potentially hidden gems.
Totally, yeah, yeah. Completely hidden gems.
Not everyone is a maven, a social maven, a social butterfly, right? Some of them have great ideas, great markets they're going after, but they just don't have the network.
That's it.
And it's unfair to be disregarding them, essentially.
That's it. So the office hours is a two-way street. So most VC firms, it's like Chesterfield Armchairs, expensive Mayfair real estate. You need like an intro to get to them, or you need to get a pitch deck into their inboxes.
Yeah.
With us, we want to keep an open door. We want people to feel engaged. We've got our blog, Part the Path Forward. We have over 220 articles covering every single pain point a startup founder might experience.
So on this point then, what major piece of advice do you have for an entrepreneur looking to raise pre-seed or seed?
Yeah, so I think there's a high element of designing in serendipity. So you've got to, first and foremost, like to decide whether or not VC is right for you. Mm. So to actually get VC interest, you have to be going after an enormous market. So depends fund by fund, is every fund's different, but every VC investor, because of the amount of, just due to fund economics, so a lot of VC-backed companies fail, you have to believe you can return the entire fund with every investment you make. Mm. So with a £60 million fund, assuming 10% of the company in 5 years at exit, then and 10x revenue multiple or something, it has to be a £600 million exit.
Right.
And there's very few markets that can satisfy that amount of demand. So we typically assume they're going to have 10% of the market, and that's an enormous market. Yeah. So your first question you have to ask, are you attacking the venture scale market?
Right.
The second one, is a very personal choice of the founder. First of all, do they have what it takes to build a scalable business?
Yeah.
And that comes through very quickly with the vision. So if they've really got the vision, they've got the hustle, and they're already kind of putting some of the things in place to sort of demonstrate their commitment, then they already come across as very credible founders. And then the final point is product. So do they have the vision of the product? Do they have an understanding of the customer?
What are your thoughts on the London VC ecosystem at the moment?
I think it's an incredible ecosystem, first and foremost. It's very tight-knit. Everyone knows each other, it seems.
Yeah.
And you very quickly become part of the fabric. It's very much very open to everyone. Even if you consider yourself a competitor to another fund, there's always going to be some deals that you won't do because it's too similar to your existing investments, it's not in your strategy, it's too early, too late stage. So there's a real incentive to know other VCs because that's how you share leads and deal flow and ultimately help entrepreneurs.
Right, very quick question. How useful is it to have a university degree?
I guess if I was Ross Bailey, who's now running a business with about £30 million a month in demand value over in total.
There's a portfolio company you've invested in, Ross Bailey.
A peer here, left school at 16. I'd probably be thinking it's absolutely irrelevant. Okay. And there's a lot of founders out there who they just got it and they find that opportunity early on.
Right. Okay.
But for a VC investor, it's fundamental. I think if you're a strategic investor, you need that discipline, you need that kind of a certain skill set you get from, it's testament to the fact that a lot of VCs have come from an investment banking or a consultancy route because you need that kind of strategic mindset, as well as knowledge across industries and all the frameworks to be able to analyze those markets in a way that ultimately gets you to a venture scale outcome.
So. Awesome. So before we finish, what's the industry that excites you the most, Al? I mean, for the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah.
Is there a specific one?
So, of course, it's applied artificial intelligence.
I could have guessed that.
But so the reason I say that is, as a VC, to diversify your portfolio, you should never be focused on a specific vertical.
Right.
So I think it's always a misnomer to focus just on one single industry. We invest on horizontals. So whether it's e-commerce, marketplace, SaaS, applied AI is almost a horizontal of another horizontal effectively. So we're looking for, the hypothesis is that AI, machine learning, it's left the research labs now. There's a lot of infrastructure out there from Apple, Microsoft, Azure, all these Google, these platforms you can build on top to build really compelling products.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it every day. We've got founders coming in building blockchain applications on IBM Chain Code. You've got chatbots being developed on Chatfuel, NLP APIs from Google coming in, or image recognition. systems built off APIs from Google again, or TensorFlow. Like, all this stuff is out there. It's just waiting for market domain experts or technical and non-technical people coming together to build something beautiful. And it's been super exciting to meet some of those people. You genuinely feel like you're seeing the future in some of the first meetings we have with founders.
Well, I mean, that's what a lot of investors say, right? What excites them about this is that you're interacting on a daily basis with entrepreneurs, high energy, passions, you know, vision. This must be exciting.
Oh, hugely, yeah.
So on this point then, and the final question to you, tell me about the company that you're most excited about when you're in Forward.
In the portfolio? There's a couple. One that we haven't closed yet, so I can't really talk about. But you know, watch this space. All I'll say is it's a phenomenal founder. She's just a real sort of tour de force, like incredible founder, attacking the childcare marketplace space. Mm. So there's this huge paradox in the UK and globally where, you know, couples want to continue their careers after they have children, but it takes a sacrifice from one of them to effectively stay and look after the kids.
Yeah.
And then if they do want to continue working, they're effectively paying for childcare. The entire salary is going towards a nanny salary. So this business is really shaking their
Looking forward to see that. So when is this happening then? When are we, two months?
Next couple of weeks we're hoping, but it's a really phenomenal business.
Awesome, that's great. Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I think it's really interesting what's happening at Forward. And wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Great. All right, everybody, that was an episode of the Business Podcast, not at Imperial College Business School today. Do make sure you subscribe on YouTube's Imperial College Business Podcast and on iTunes as well. Thanks a lot, businesspodcast.co. Take care. Bye-bye.